From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Social Security and the Clinton budget proposal. We talk with Max Richman of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Richman is critical of the president's plan and has some of his own ideas about how to take care of inequities in the fund. Also, who controls Russia's history now that the party no longer does? We talk with journalist David Remnick, author of the new book Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire. Remnick covered the Soviet Union for the Washington Post from 1988 to 91. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Jurassic Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. As the Senate continues to search for an alternative to President Clinton's budget that can win enough votes, the president tried to assure angry House members who feel they've walked the plank for the president and got nothing in return. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
While Senate Democrats looked at a proposal that would replace Clinton's energy tax, based on the heat content of fuel, with a tax on transportation fuels, President Clinton continued to distance himself from the negotiations. "I haven't signed off on any proposal yet," the president said. He reassured the House that its budget would be part of the final conference committee negotiations. Mr. Clinton says he still prefers his version of the energy tax to the one under consideration by the Senate, based on a higher gasoline tax. Today, that alternative came under attack from Western senators who feel it would hurt their states and from liberals in the House and Senate who object to the deeper Medicare and Medicaid cuts the plan calls for to make up for the smaller amount of money raised through taxes. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The UN Security Council took steps today that could lead to putting monitors on the border between Serbia and Bosnia. The 15-member council unanimously passed a resolution calling on the organization to study the use of monitors, including air surveillance, to see whether weapons and other supplies are getting to the Bosnian Serbs. The monitoring program would be aimed at holding Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic to his promise to cut strategic supplies to the Bosnian Serbs after they rejected an international peace plan. Muslim and Croat commanders in central Bosnia have signed a new ceasefire aimed at stopping the latest round of fighting around the town of Travnik. Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
The agreement was signed by the commander of the Bosnian Croat army and the newly appointed commander-in-chief of the Muslim-led government forces, Colonel Rasim Dalic. The fact that Dalic was involved was one reason why United Nations military officials were cautiously optimistic that this ceasefire might be somewhat more solid than the many others which have failed to halt the painful process of communal separation in former Yugoslavia. In Syria, at least, the new agreement would not only halt that fighting between Bosnian Croats and Muslims, it would reverse that separation process of so-called ethnic cleansing. Both sides pledged to allow the many displaced civilians to return to their homes with guarantees of safety. They also promised to release all prisoners by next Tuesday and to allow the free and safe movement of relief convoys. But many war-weary Bosnians will believe it when they see it happening. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Sarajevo.
The Dow Industrials lost 20 points today to close at 3,491.7. Declines led advances by 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. The United Mine Workers Union expanded its strike against the nation's coal producers today, calling another 3,000 miners off the job. The latest expansion will put 12,000 miners on the picket lines, making the strike the biggest called by the UMW since 1981. The new targets are 16 mines operated by Peabody Holding Company and Consol Energy, the nation's two biggest coal producers in West Virginia, Illinois, and Kentucky. It's the first time mines in Kentucky have been affected. Hillary Rodham Clinton went to the Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore today to talk about what health care reform might mean to doctors and to research institutions. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The First Lady, who is formulating the administration's plans to revamp the nation's health care system, says the country has too many specialists. She promised a receptive audience of doctors at the Johns Hopkins Medical School that large research hospitals will always be important, but medical schools also have to think about training more people for primary care.
We will have to alter the incentives that are currently there if we are to have an adequate supply of primary care physicians.
One way to do that, she said, is with loan repayment programs for doctors who go into general practice. She also said that despite what the public may think, controlling medical costs is not simply a matter of limiting what doctors and hospitals can charge. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The White House said today that meaningful efforts to cut the deficit should also help keep interest rates down. Spokeswoman Dee Dee Myers said the president had an hour-long private meeting last night with Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. She said Greenspan told the president that current deficit-cutting efforts should ease fears of inflation and help keep interest rates from climbing. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Social Security. We all hope it gets us through our retirement years. But Social Security has become very controversial because it is the most expensive of all our entitlement programs. And many politicians and economists agree that we won't be able to lower the deficit unless we cut back on entitlement programs such as Social Security, welfare, Medicare, and Medicaid. President Clinton's economic package, which the Senate will soon vote on, would increase taxes on Social Security income. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Max Richman, Executive Vice President of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We wanted him, among other things, to respond to criticisms of the Social Security system that were recently made on our program by Philip Longman, author of a forthcoming book on entitlements. First, let's hear a couple of points that Longman made about why the Social Security system needs to be reformed.
I think we have to make it closer to what it was originally intended to be, which is a social insurance program against the very real possibility that any of us may become poor in old age. Unfortunately, it has over the years evolved into something quite different than that. Currently, Social Security and Medicare together are distributing about $75 billion a year to people who earn more than $50,000 a year. And, of course, it's raising that money largely through, or exclusively through, a payroll tax on younger workers that hits the poor hardest. Again, even if we didn't need this money for investments in the future, this would simply be an unfair and untenable income redistribution system.
Now, I think most of us think of Social Security like this. During our working years, we put in a certain amount of money. Then when we retire, we get that money back, and that money sustains us in our retirement years. And it's upsetting to think that the government's going to, like, change the rules on us, and that when we retire, we're going to make less than what we expected, or less than what we were promised.
Unfortunately, it's convenient as it is to believe it. It's just not true. People retiring today can look forward to, on average, about a $32,000 a year windfall profit. That is, if you take the total amount of contributions that they've made to Social Security on average over their working lives, you adjust it for inflation. It still comes out that the average retiree today, just in the Social Security program, is getting it back about two and a half times what he paid in. Or put another way, he'll get back in the first 10 years of his retirement what he paid in, yet the life tables tell us on average they'll live 20 years.
The Social Security system was started under the Roosevelt administration in 1935. Were there certain New Deal assumptions that you think are no longer true in the 1990s?
Actually, it's not the assumptions that were made in the 1930s so much as the assumptions that were made in the 1970s and 60s when the Social Security program was dramatically expanded. And those assumptions were that the baby boom that was going on at that time would continue forever, that there would be ever higher birth rates in the United States so that you'd have ever more people paying into the system, and probably more profoundly, that the next generation would grow up to be many, many times more affluent than the current generation. You probably remember some of the atmosphere of the early 1970s, but this was a time when economists testified before Congress and seriously estimated that within 20 years, the American workforce would be working an average of 20 hours a week and making four or five times the average wage of workers in 1970. Well, I mean, it would have been nice if it was true, but it didn't happen. Unfortunately, they structured the financing of Social Security and many other entitlements as if it were going to happen. And that is the key policy error that was made.
I know that you think that Social Security is inequitably distributed, that people who have a lot of money end up getting more money than those who really need the money. Do you have any statistics handy about how the money, for instance, was distributed in 1992? Who got what?
For Social Security program in itself, spent $55 billion last year conveying benefits to families that had income over $50,000 a year. Now, just to put that in perspective, if we took $10 billion and applied it specifically to the problem of eliminating totally poverty among the elderly, $10 billion would do it. If you took $10 billion and targeted it at the remaining elderly population that is poor, that would be enough to lift every one of them above the poverty line. And yet we spent five times that much money, $55 billion, paying Social Security benefits to people who typically use them for paying for their green fees and traveling to tropical ports of call and tooting around the country in an RV with a bumper sticker that says we're outspending our children's inheritance. There's just no reason to be spending that kind of money on people that don't need it, not in the current context.
An excerpt of an earlier interview with Philip Longman. He writes for Florida Trend magazine. The National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare is afraid that critiques like Longman's could lead to the eventual dismantling of the Social Security system. Max Richman is the executive vice president of the National Committee. He says that when Clinton was running for president, he promised not to touch Social Security, but his new budget proposal includes an increased tax on benefits.
Under current law, and for the last 10 years, Social Security beneficiaries have been paying tax on their benefits, half of their benefits, if their incomes exceeded certain thresholds. And that is $25,000 per year for an individual, $32,000 per year for a couple. The proposal in the Clinton budget plan, which has now been passed as part of the House reconciliation bill, would raise that level of taxation from 50% to 85%. Now, keep in mind, that's a 70% increase on the tax on Social Security benefits. Another deficiency in the taxation of benefits issue, as it's been prepared by the President and passed by the House of Representatives, is that in 1983, for the first time ever in 50 years, nearly 50 years, Social Security benefits were taxed. That revenue from the increase in taxation was going to go back to the trust fund, shore up the trust fund, make it solvent for the next 50, 60 years. Now the revenue is going to be used not only to reduce the deficit, not do anything for the trust fund, the increased revenue from the increase in taxation, but the thresholds at which an individual begins paying taxes remains the same. Now, in 1984, the first year that beneficiaries had to pay tax on their Social Security benefits, 8% of beneficiaries paid the tax. This year, it's 22%. By the year 1997, nearly 30% of Social Security beneficiaries will be paying the tax. These thresholds of $25,000 for an individual and $32,000 a couple have remained the same for the last 10 years. And it's very similar to what's known as bracket creep in the income tax program. Just by virtue of getting your cost of living adjustment and inflation, you can be moved into this category of beneficiaries that have to pay tax on their benefits. That's not fair. Those thresholds should have been indexed in the first place and should continue to be indexed.
The president's plan would raise the amount of income that was taxable from 50% to 85%. What would happen to the extra money that was generated by the added tax?
Well, that's a very good question. Just by way of background, the first time Social Security benefits were ever taxed, beginning in 1984, at the 50% level, seniors were reluctant to go along with that, but they did so. And one of the reasons they did so was that was part of the overall rescue of the Social Security program. Those revenues derived from that taxation were plowed back into the Social Security Trust Fund to make sure that the system was solvent, would pay benefits for current and future retirees until the year 2043. But now, this additional revenue, and it's around $30 billion over 5 years, that's not going to the Social Security Trust Fund. That's going to go to reduce the deficit. Now, here's a program in government, Social Security, one of the very, very few programs in government that is running at a surplus. And it's going to be used to balance the budget, to help balance the budget. Where's the fairness in that philosophy? We fail to see it.
Well, if Social Security is running at a surplus, why not take some money from Social Security and use it to balance the budget?
Well, because that money is dedicated money. It's a trust fund. It's supposed to be used to pay benefits, not to balance the federal budget. I guess what our perception is, Social Security did not create the deficit. Why are you using Social Security to help solve the deficit?
What impact would it have on the future of Social Security if more money were taken out of the fund and used to fight the deficit?
Well, this money is not being taken out of the fund. It's being taken out of senior citizens' pockets. It's really a backdoor way of cutting benefits. Instead of saying your benefits are going to be lower because we're going to reduce your cost of living adjustment or reduce the formula by which benefits are derived, we're just going to tax your benefits. So the trust fund is not going to be impacted, but the individual beneficiaries, the bottom line is, they're going to have less left of their Social Security checks by the end of the year. In effect, the average person would be giving up 1 month of Social Security. That's what the additional tax on benefits for the average beneficiary will add up to by the end of the year, roughly 1 month of a Social Security beneficiary's income.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Max Richman. He's the Executive Vice President of the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Let me get to some of the more general criticisms that have been made about the Social Security system. And some of these criticisms were actually recently made on Fresh Air by one of our guests. One of the criticisms is that people now are getting more money than they paid in, more money than they paid in plus interest. Do you think that's true, and do you think that that's fair?
Well, for many years, there was quite a bit of truth to that. And people that were retiring were getting back all that they put in, all that their employer put in, plus interest in a fairly short amount of time. But that's no longer the case. People retiring now, this year, it will take them roughly 11, 12 years to recoup their investment in Social Security, their employer's investment, plus the interest. So while that may have been a criticism that some thought was relevant and to the debate of Social Security in years past, it really has no relevance anymore, in my opinion.
One criticism made about Social Security is that today's working class, which is struggling to support themselves on their paychecks, are paying payroll taxes that are being used to fund Social Security for affluent retirees. Do you think that that's a legitimate criticism? Do you think that the affluent should be making less than they are in Social Security?
There are really two points that I think I need to respond to answer that question thoroughly. First of all, if you are affluent and you don't want your Social Security check, you don't have to. You don't have to keep it. You can send it back to the government. But to force a division among seniors as to who is entitled to a Social Security check and who is not really goes to the heart of the Social Security program. And it would be that kind of a forced division by the government, or distinction, or entitlement test, if you want to call it that. That's a popular term these days, would be the first step towards dismantling the Social Security program. Sure, you could say if you have income of $250,000 a year, why do you need Social Security? You should be denied your Social Security. But where would that end? If the Congress and the senior community and the people in this country accepted that proposition, we know darn well that very soon that threshold would start creeping down, and pretty soon you'd have very low income levels would be receiving smaller checks. Now, the reason Social Security works so well and is universally accepted is that virtually everybody participates and everybody benefits. Once you make these divisions, you're going to start taking the program apart. And that making distinctions in Social Security, such as the one you've just discussed, is the first step towards turning a social insurance program into a welfare program.
Is there anything else you would say to somebody who's struggling to get by today and feels that they're paying taxes that are supporting cruises and golf club memberships for retirees?
Well, I would say that those people should work with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare and others who have been supporting Senator Moynihan over the last couple of years. He's now the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee in cutting payroll taxes. We don't believe that payroll taxes need to be at the level that they're at. The Social Security program is building a surplus of enormous proportions. The surplus is growing. That is, more money is being taken in than is being paid out. It is growing at the rate of $1.5 billion a week. We don't need the kinds of payroll taxes that are now in place to fund Social Security. We need a sound system. We need a sound and stable reserve, enough to cover beneficiaries in the event that the economy goes downhill quickly. But we don't need that kind of payroll structure that is really hurting the working class.
There is a surplus in the Social Security system now. But a lot of younger people worry that the system will run out of money by the time that they retire. A previous guest on our show predicted that the Social Security system would be bankrupt in 17 years. What kind of shape do you think the future of Social Security is
in? Well, your previous guest should refresh his memory by looking at the Social Security Actuaries Report. Those figures by the Social Security actuaries are given credence by everyone in government, and those figures show that even using intermediate economic assumptions, the Social Security system is solvent and has money to pay beneficiaries till about the year 2041 to 2043. Now, that's almost 50 years from now. At some point, when we get close to that magic year, the Congress will have to look at benefits, will have to look at payroll taxes, will have to look at the year qualifying for benefits and consider making adjustments at that point. But for the next nearly 50 years, the Social Security system is sound. Now, I don't know any program in government that goes beyond 50 years. Most of these budget plans, you know, only deal 5 years out, and that's considered plenty of time to make adjustments.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Max Richmond, and he's vice president of the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Max Richmond is my guest, Executive Vice President of the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Are there inequities in the Social Security system that you would like to see addressed, even though you don't want the system means-tested?
Oh, there are many, many inequities. There are some ways in which Social Security could be improved. It could be fair. It could provide better service. I'll give you a couple. First of all, there is in law now something that's called the earnings test. If you are a Social Security beneficiary and you earn above about $10,000 a year, because you need to work to make ends meet. Social Security, as you know, does not take care of everything. You will be penalized and lose some of your benefits. You will lose a dollar in benefits for every $3 you earn above that threshold. I think it's about $10,200 a year right now. That law makes no sense. That law was passed back during the Depression when we had an enormous unemployment rate in this country. And the theory behind the law was to encourage older workers to leave the workforce. If you penalized them, took away some of their benefits if they worked, they were less likely to stay in the workforce when they reached retirement age and less likely to return to the workforce. Well, that law is a relic of a bygone era, and it makes no sense at this point in time to penalize senior citizens who need to work so they don't have to make the decision between buying their medicine or paying their gas bill.
People who don't have a lot of savings would try to make extra income while they're on Social Security by working, and as you said, their wages over $10,000 would be taxed. But people who are more affluent have income generated by dividends on stocks and bonds. Do you think that there's an inequity there?
Well, there certainly is. You know, if you have invested your money and you're you're in a position where you can earn income through interest and dividends, stocks, bonds, CDs, you can have as much income in that way as you have been able to establish for yourself, and it's not going to affect your Social Security. But if you have to go out and work and earn money, then you're going to be penalized.
There's currently a ceiling of $56,000 on salary for the payroll tax that goes into Social Security. Would you explain that and give us your opinion of it?
Well, under current law, there's a formula that applies to how much of your income is subject to Social Security tax, how much of it is withheld, your FICA tax. That goes up every year a little bit based on inflation, and there's an indexing formula. And as you point out, this year it's around $57,000. After you reach that $57,000 mark, an employee will be no longer required to have his Social Security tax withheld. In other words, what that means is if somebody is making $56,000 or $57,000 a year, he or she is paying as much into the Social Security system as somebody making $157,000 or $257,000 or any unlimited amount. That is the point at which this year the individual will not be required to pay into the Social Security system. There's an awful lot of revenue that could be derived for very important programs if that ceiling was raised. I think if it were raised $20,000 or $30,000 per year up to, let's say, $75,000 or $85,000 a year, you could derive enough revenue to fund, for example, a comprehensive long-term care health care program for all people.
Max Richmond, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Max Richmond is Executive Vice President of the Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Remnick was among what he describes as the luckiest generation of foreign reporters in the Soviet Union, the last generation which witnessed the empire's collapse. Coming up, we talk with Remnick about what it was like to watch the Soviet people learn the truth about the atrocities their leaders were responsible for. Remnick is the author of the new book, Lenin's Tomb. He covered the Soviet Union for the Washington Post. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Steven Spielberg film, Jurassic Park. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. As Senate Democrats continue working to alter President Clinton's budget package, Mr. Clinton today sought to reassure angry House members who voted for his original plan. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Numerous House Democrats feel as though they stuck their necks out politically by voting for the president's controversial BTU energy tax last month. Now, as the Senate appears likely to scrap the BTU tax in favor of a smaller levy, many in the House are fuming that Mr. Clinton has abandoned them. But today, during a photo opportunity at the White House, the president tried to assure the House members that he has not yet agreed to any Senate proposal.
They didn't walk the plank on the budget for nothing. Their budget is going to be part of the conference. And they are being consulted now, and no decision has been made by the Senate yet.
One big problem for the president is the Congressional Black Caucus, which has been threatening not to support the altered bill when it comes back from the Senate. Mr. Clinton today told the caucus that the BTU tax will still be on the table when the budget goes to conference committee. I'm Andy Bowers in Washington.
U.S. officials have announced plans to send some 300 soldiers to Macedonia in a U.N. peacekeeping effort to keep the fighting in Bosnia from spreading. It's the first U.S. commitment to put soldiers on the ground in the region. U.S. officials say that the U.S. troops will play only an observer role and will arrive in Macedonia sometime next week. Secretary of State Warren Christopher told a NATO meeting today in Athens that the fighting in Bosnia must not be allowed to spill over. The U.S. troops will join more than 700 U.N. peacekeepers on borders with Serbia and Albania. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has opened his special constitutional conference. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Today, President Boris Yeltsin told the conference's 700 delegates that he does not oppose a full discussion of all of Russia's current draft constitutions. Yeltsin has offered his own with a strong presidency and a two-chamber parliament as the conference's basic document, but many delegates have proposed changes taken from a draft developed in the Russian parliament. Parliament Speaker Ruslan Hasbulatov, who tried to address the conference on its first day, was offered time today to speak, but unexpectedly took ill. Hasbulatov's attempts to undermine the conference's legitimacy seem to be failing, as more and more of his parliamentary lieutenants are deserting him and cooperating with the conference. There are still plenty of disagreements, though, especially over the status of Russia's ethnic autonomous republics, and few delegates believe there will be agreement on a final draft by the conference's last day, June 16th. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says that he has reached agreement with Germany over contracts for telecommunications, lifting sanctions imposed by both sides. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 20 points to close at 3,491.72 on volume of 228 million shares. This is NPR News. Speaking today at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, Hillary Rodham Clinton said that cutting fees made to doctors and hospitals would not solve the nation's health care problems. Mrs. Clinton called on the nation's medical schools to cut back on the number of medical specialists graduating and add to the number of family doctors in the country to work in inner cities and outlying areas. At present, only about 30% of the nation's doctors are concentrating on primary care. And surveys of some 126 medical schools indicate that less than 15% of recent graduates are going into general medicine. Mrs. Clinton received a standing ovation at the end of her speech. There are already 2 million AIDS orphans in the world, children whose parents have died of AIDS. According to experts at the International AIDS Conference, in 7 years, there will be an estimated 10 million AIDS orphans in the world. NPR's Chitra Raghavan reports from Berlin.
AIDS experts said today that families are being destroyed by the disease. Right now, almost all the AIDS orphans are in Africa. In Uganda alone, there are 1.5 million kids who've lost one or both parents. Families have to sell their lands to pay for the cost of funerals and the needs of the children. Once the parents die, orphans are cared for by their aunts and grandparents. But because there are many large families, old grandparents often care for as many as 35 children. Experts are finding that most of these orphans are becoming sexually active at a very young age. But because their extended families are so burdened, no one has the time to teach them to take precautions, so they don't. I'm Chitra Raghavan in Berlin.
The government says that new claims for unemployment benefits dropped in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says that new claims were down by 2,000 in the week ending June 5th to a seasonally adjusted 345,000 claims. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. David Remnick was among what he considers to be the luckiest generation of foreign correspondents in the Soviet Union, the generation that covered the collapse of the empire. Remnick covered the Soviet Union for The Washington Post from 1988 to 91. In his new book, Lenin's Tomb, he writes that once the Soviet regime eased up enough to permit a full-scale examination of the Soviet past, the system was doomed. His book is about the return of history to the Soviet Union. The book opens with a dramatic example of how the truth was literally unearthed under Gorbachev. In 1991, the Soviet military was under orders to dig up a mass grave of Polish soldiers who were killed by Stalin's men in 1940. I asked Remnick to tell us the story.
Around the time of the war, Stalin wanted to make sure that he would have no trouble with the Poles. And he had mass executions, most notably in Katyn, but in two other locations, one of them near the city that was once called Kalinin and now Tver. And one of the main themes of the book is the opening up of history. And one of the bones of contention for a long time between the Poles and particularly Polish dissidents and the Soviet regime were these massacres in Katyn and in the other locations. And it was only with Gorbachev's opening of history that it was admitted that it was the Soviet regime that did this and not the Nazis. And so these excavations were going on. And on the day of the coup, the local KGB chief came and told this military leader who was leading the excavation, he said, it's time to stop, which I thought was a great symbol of the coup's intentions, the attempt to roll back all the advances that had been made up until August 91.
So tell me more about what this story means to you, about who controls history and why that's so important.
Well, the regime controlled history almost from the beginning. Stalin certainly created a kind of institution or foundation of lies upon which the entire regime was based. All things true about mass murder or collectivization or murders at Katyn or the history of the Cold War. All of these things were erased from history. History was under the control of the regime. And I thought, despite Gorbachev's ambitions in the economy and elsewhere, that the most important thing he did early on in November 87 was to begin this process of opening up history to first to the Communist Party in a liberalized version, but then finally to historians and journalists and to ordinary people. And I thought this was a great symbol of the feeble attempt to bring back the old Stalinist version of history. And of course it failed instantly because not only did the coup fail, but even before that, the local military chief looked the KGB straight in the eye and said no, and the digging continued.
You write that you often accidentally wandered into old prison camps. And this is another example of how the past was always present but often hidden. How would you wander into old prison camps?
Well, sometimes it happened very deliberately. I would go looking for it in Kalima, which is in the Far East near the city of Magadan, or in Perm 35, which was one of the last of the prisons that held political prisoners. But one day I was in northern Kazakhstan, in the Russian part of Kazakhstan, and I was doing a piece about miners. There are a lot of miners and chemical workers there. And we were taking a walk one day with a local leader of the miners' union, and we went into what seemed like an abandoned kindergarten, and there were drawings on the wall of you know, kangaroos and giraffes and all the rest. And then I noticed there was a kind of gutter along the floor, and there were other features that had more to do with prisons and execution rooms than it would with a kindergarten. And it seemed that this had first been built as a barracks and a killing floor, so to speak, and then it became a kindergarten, and then it was finally abandoned, which is not a bad series of metaphors for the Soviet regime.
What a weird thought to think of a kindergarten in the place of a prison.
Nothing is a weird thought in the former Soviet Union. You know, I had friends who I went up to visit them once, and they said, "And by the way, you know, this building we're sitting in right now was built by prisoners." Well, that was common enough. And he said, "Well, one of the prisoners was Alexander Solzhenitsyn." You know, things like this would happen to you every day. A friend of mine I went to visit said, "I'm really desperate to interview Lazar Kaganovich, who was the last living member of the inner circle for Stalin." And he said, "That's funny. Lazar Kaganovich lives five floors down from me." And so he did. And I used to stuff notes under his door and knock on his door. It was very bizarre. It was like sort of knocking on Himmler's door. But I never did get to see him. He was too smart for that.
Yeah, he refused to give you an interview. And your neighbor, you know, who lived upstairs from him, said, "Well, what do you think you're going to get? You're thinking to get him to confess to you, to apologize?"
Well, she's absolutely right. I mean, it was, you know, that was sort of journalistic folly to think that you know, the brave young American would walk right through the door, and he would say, "I'm so sorry for those tens of millions of people. When can I begin my social work?"
Your book is entitled Lenin's Tomb. What part does Lenin's tomb play in the rewriting of Soviet history?
Well, it's funny because Lenin's tomb is still sitting there on Red Square. And so far as I know, Komar and Melamed, who are these wonderful artists who live now in New York and New Jersey, emigres, have just had a competition in Moscow and now in New York on proposals on what to do with Lenin's tomb now that it's become something of a historical irrelevance.
It's really funny because the work they do is a kind of parody almost of Soviet social realism.
Exactly. It's such good socialist realism with a twist. And there are proposals to turn it into a bowling alley or a racquetball court or change it. It says Lenin on it. And maybe they should change it to Leninism or even you remember that scene at the end of the coup of the crane that came and carried away the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the KGB. And they thought maybe they should dangle that statue by the neck over Lenin mausoleum. But in the meantime, it's still there. And one of the things that helped erase the mystery of the Soviet regime for me was to discover that under the Holy of Holies, which is where Lenin lays under a bulletproof glass and under the temperature control of the Russian Institute of Herbs and Aromatic Plants, in floors below that, there are gymnasiums. There's a gymnasium for the guards. There's a urinal, there's a laboratory, there are kitchens in case Politburo members want to go down there while the parade is going on and they get a little hungry. So this was all part of the demystification process for everybody.
Well, my guest is David Remnick, and he covered the Soviet Union from 88 to 91 for The Washington Post. His new book is called Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist David Remnick is my guest, author of the new book, Lenin's Tomb. We were talking about who owns history, and when the party stopped controlling history, they also stopped controlling the Soviet Union. Who owns the history of the attempted coup?
That's a very good question. The coup trial is being put off again and again. 11 of the 13 people under indictment have tried to blame Gorbachev for either organizing this explicitly or more subtly than that. So certainly Gorbachev doesn't want to see a trial go on for very long or have it be a very noisy thing. It's embarrassing to him because a lot of people are inclined to believe them. I don't. Obviously, the conspirators don't want a trial because they think all they were guilty of doing is restoring order in their country and bringing back a semblance of normalcy. That's understandable. But the Yeltsin government, I don't think, is terribly interested in a long, drawn-out public trial on these people. It's very politically divisive. It's diverting in a way that they can't stand. For the same reasons that the Clinton administration doesn't want to see long confirmation hearings on matters of ideology while it's fumbling in other parts of the administration, the Yeltsin administration doesn't want to see a divisive political trial because they can only lose.
You were in the Soviet Union during the attempted coup. Can you tell us one of the more dramatic stories that you were there witnessing?
Well, I think the most dramatic thing for me was to see ordinary people who you were not used to seeing at political demonstrations go out and stay up all night, for 2-3 days running. Coup lasted 3 days and a bit, and essentially put their lives on the line. I met a seamstress, for example, who heard that there had been a coup at her factory. She had never been politically involved, but the most important thing to her politically was that for the first time in her life and for the first time in the history of Russia, she had gone to the polls and in a legitimate ballot had elected a president. And now that president was under threat. His life was under threat. His power was under threat, such as it was. And she went straight to the White House and stood on a barricade and held a banner saying, soldiers, don't shoot your mothers. And I just thought this, you know, things like this were extraordinarily moving to me. And, you know, the examples are in the dozens and hundreds and thousands. And I fear that I hear in a lot of commentaries that people are saying, well, you know, only several tens of thousands of people went out to defend the White House, so that means all the others are not interested in the least in democracy. Well, I think that's nonsense. I think that in the effort to demythologize the resistance to the coup, there's a kind of slandering of those defenders, unfortunately. You know, most revolutions are not made by the majority of the public, and most defenses, whether it's in the French Revolution or even, God forbid, in the Russian Revolution, have nothing to do with the majority of the people. Life just goes on all around it, and politics takes place in a very small core of geography and a small core of people.
I was interested in hearing about how ambivalent your family was about you going to the Soviet Union to write about it. All of your grandparents were from Russia.
Well, if you go back far enough, but my grandfathers were both born in Russia and left before the revolution, were happy to have done so. And my wife, who is Esther Fine and who writes for the Enemy, for the New York Times, at that time I was with the Washington Post, her grandfather died in the camps, was killed in the camps. And so to announce to our parents, A, we're getting married, and B, we're leaving for Russia in 3 months, 3 months after the wedding, was a bit of a jolt to all concerned. My in-laws swore that they'd never come because my mother-in-law had, after all, been in the camps. I mean, she had no great interest in going back to Russia. I mean, what for? Who could blame her? And the only thing that really brought her there was the birth of a grandson.
Mm-hmm. You say that your grandparents could never understand this, like, interest in roots. You know, why would you want to go to or learn more about the Soviet Union? But did you end up visiting roots kinds of places, visiting places that you knew were important in your grandparents' lives?
I did, but it was a rather sad attempt, I have to tell you, because I come from Russian Jews, and they were not very high-born, and they lived in shtetls and tiny villages, and all of them are pretty much gone by now. And one of them had been in the area of the city in Lithuania called Vilnius, and the other near Kiev. And those little shtetls, those towns, had disappeared with the wind long ago. And so there really was no linking, except in the most general and sad way. You know, walking into synagogues and seeing very old relics still at it, using the synagogue to some extent as a religious gathering place and more for a kind of social connection.
Mm-hmm. Explain something to me. You write that you turned out between 300 and 400 stories a year, mm-hmm, for the Washington Post. Given that there's only 365 days in the year, how could you turn out 400 stories?
You could write two or three in a day. And some of these stories didn't require great intellectual or even reporting effort. Stories floated onto your lap like snowflakes in a storm. I remember going into the office one night and thinking, well, God, we have nothing out of Moscow today. That's ridiculous. I will read Izvestia and a story will come of it. And there were three stories in Izvestia because this was a time when truth-telling was coming in such a flood and after decades of drought that everything was interesting. Now, I think reporting out of Moscow has changed dramatically. What we're seeing from the best reporters there now is fewer stories, longer and more developed stories, explaining in greater detail of what's going on. Because, after all, the rush has faded somewhat. The interest even has subsided a bit because the sense of crisis, rightly or wrongly, has subsided.
Well, before we let you go, I'd be interested in hearing what you think of Yeltsin.
Well, it was said in one review that I'm somehow in love with Yeltsin. I don't think this is true. He is a politician of his time. And what I like about Yeltsin and what I like about Gorbachev is that they came in the right order. They were somehow descended from the heavens of history at precisely the right time to do precisely the right thing for once. You know, history is so filled with demons and accidents and catastrophe that these two men came in the right order. If Yeltsin had come first in 85, 86, it would have been a historical disaster. He really was not up to that kind of politically subtle job. On the other hand, Gorbachev was not up to finishing the job that occurred in 1990-1991.
David Remnick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Remnick is the author of the new book Lenin's Tomb: The Last Days of the Soviet Empire. He writes for The New Yorker. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear about the news that the United States intends to send 300 troops to Macedonia. It's one of the former Yugoslav republics, to support the UN force there. It's a sign that any aggression by Serbia against Macedonia would be considered an offense that we'd reply to with force. Also today, we'll be hearing about General Colin Powell's speech at Harvard University. And we'll also be hearing about the rising intonation, which I don't know about you, but to my ear seems to be increasingly common. You know what I'm talking about?
The rising intonation?
Precisely. It seems to be increasingly common statements which sound to me as if they're questions.
Can't wait to hear it. Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Michael Crichton wrote the bestseller, and now Steven Spielberg has made the film. Is Jurassic Park the most eagerly awaited film of the summer? Of course. And is it worth the wait? Film critic Stephen Schiff has some answers.
High concept is what you call a movie that you can sum up in a single sentence. So what do you call a movie that you can sum up in a single word? You call it Jurassic Park. And the word, of course, is dinosaurs. Going in, you know that if the reptiles really rip, so will the movie. And in Steven Spielberg's hands, T-Rex and associates rip up a storm. This is a movie with a mess of a plot, lackluster characters, overawed acting, and a bad habit of turning preachy whenever the action lulls. But the rest is movie magic. Spielberg not only gives us a plethora of dinosaurs, almost all of them completely believable, he also gives us a scary whiff of primordial nightmare. By the end of this movie, you may find yourself thinking that many of our deepest fears of monsters and aliens and whatever's under the bed, that all of that is reducible to the fear of dinosaurs, that our terror of them might even be part of the cellular structure we inherited from the forest primeval. The movie is blatantly constructed as an amusement park ride. After a confused and hectic opening, we settle in on a gaggle of characters who are invited by the mad mogul John Hammond, played by Richard Attenborough, to tour the Caribbean island where he's about to open his new amusement park. By extracting DNA out of dinosaur blood preserved in a prehistoric mosquito, Hammond and his scientists have been able to clone dinosaurs of every kind, so that we, the tourists of tomorrow, can visit them as if they were zoo animals. But the mathematician Ian Malcolm, played by Jeff Goldblum, isn't crazy about the idea.
Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
It's hardly appropriate to start hurling generalizations.
If I may, I'll tell you the problem with the scientific power that you're using here. It didn't require any discipline to attain it. You stood on the shoulders of geniuses to accomplish something as fast as you could, and before you even knew what you had, you patented it and packaged it and slapped it on a plastic lunchbox, and now you're selling it. You want to sell it. Well,
I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before.
Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they didn't stop to think if they should.
Sure enough, everything that can go wrong does go wrong. And pretty soon the dinosaurs are running wild, in the middle of the night, during a tropical storm. Their putative prey are our heroes, Goldblum, a couple of betrothed paleontologists, played by Sam Neill and Laura Dern, and Hammond's own young grandchildren, who face not only hungry thunder lizards, but runaway cars and electrified fences. The movie's more than a little reminiscent of the thrill-a-minute Indiana Jones pictures, and of Jaws, and even of Close Encounters as well. But Jurassic Park doesn't resonate the way some of those movies do. Its Frankenstein-like message about how naughty it is to fool with Mama Nature feels pretty stale. And beyond that, there's not much here but thrills. The thrills, though, are the real thing. The way Spielberg stages the approach of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, for instance, or the scene in which two wily velociraptors chase the children in an enormous industrial kitchen. This is Spielberg's best work since the beginning of Empire of the Sun back in 1987. But I know your next question. Will Jurassic Park give small children nightmares? The answer is yes, almost certainly. And maybe you, too.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a rare opportunity to hear director Martin Scorsese discuss his films. We'll broadcast a talk Scorsese gave earlier this week in New York. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy.